Hello and welcome to the second episode of the Marie Keating Foundation Talks Cancer podcast. We're delighted to be back and share even more valuable information with you about prostate cancer. And today we delve into the treatment options. We have an incredible lineup of guests to talk us through a number of treatment options in depth and the necessary considerations when deciding on a treatment pathway. We're joined by Mr. Richie Power from Beaumont Hospital, Dr. Gerard McVeigh from St. Luke's Hospital, and Dr. Waseem Darwish from the Mater Hospital.
Richie, it's great to have you here with us today. Thanks so much for being here. Richie Power is consultant urologist and transplant surgeon at Beaumont Hospital. And I know you've had a very busy morning, Richie. You've actually done a couple of transplants already. So it's our privilege to have you here. So thank you for taking the time.
Not at all, Helen. It's a great pleasure. And thank you for the invitation here for this very appropriate and timely podcast, I think. I've had a busy morning. Part of my job involves renal transplantation since I took up consultant urologist and transplant surgeon post in Beaumont, actually coming up to just September 2006 it was when I returned from working in Australia, having completed fellowship training there. So I've been 16 years in Beaumont Hospital working at the forefront of kidney transplantation and urological oncology, in particular prostate cancer.
Richie, it's great that we're going to talk surgery for prostate cancer today, where it's appropriate, of course. But first of all, I just want to say that surgery for some stages and grades of prostate cancer is not always necessary. Can you explain that for us?
So when you're faced with a diagnosis of any cancer, obviously for the patient, it's a traumatic, potentially life-changing event for the person themselves and indeed potentially their partner or family members. But prostate cancer is quite a different cancer than a lot of other cancers that men or indeed persons are diagnosed within their life span. Indeed, it is the most common cancer after skin cancer to be diagnosed in the male population. Approximately, the incidence is about 1 in 7 men will encounter a diagnosis of prostate cancer in their life. If you have a family history of a first degree relative, 1 in 5 men. So the incidence is starkly high. However, an awful lot of prostate cancers that are diagnosed are what we call low-grade or indolent prostate cancers. And we do have a grading system for prostate cancer. And what the grading system is in layman's terms is a description of the degree of aggressiveness of it. So if you have a low-grade prostate cancer, we use this scoring system called Gleason scoring. And Gleason scoring is what the pathologist grades the tumor when they look down the microscope. They say, yes, there is cancer cells there, or there's no cancer cells there. If there is cancer cells there, they talk about the grade of it. And if you have a low-grade or a Gleason 6 prostate cancer, most international experts and the consensus opinion on that is that Gleason 6 prostate cancer will not cause your demise and will not cause any significant morbidity if it remains as a Gleason 6 prostate cancer for the rest of its time. So active surveillance is something that has evolved over the last 2 decades really of prostate cancer management, and it was really born out of Scandinavian countries where they had a very good understanding of the natural history of prostate cancer. And then a gentleman called Larry Klotz became the godfather of active surveillance and a big proponent of it out of Toronto in Canada. Now, it's not surprising that two countries like Canada and indeed Sweden were at the proponents of active surveillance, because active surveillance means you're not treating the cancer, and you have to, being a little bit skeptical about things, you have to look at some developed countries around the world whereby if you have a diagnosis of a cancer, the hospital system doesn't get remuneration unless it's treated. So okay, it didn't actually, and that's being a little bit cynical about it, but one has to be careful when looking at the literature internationally. Back 2 decades ago, very few men were offered active surveillance for prostate cancer in North America, i.e. in the United States of America, or indeed in Australia. Whereas nowadays, approximately, some studies would say 14, 15%, but I would say about a fifth of patients, so up to 20% of patients, are appropriately offered active surveillance. Now, what does this mean? It means that they have a diagnosis of a low-grade, non-aggressive prostate cancer, and then they are deemed suitable for surveillance or active surveillance, whereby they do not undergo any radical treatment. So there is no curative treatment given. They are just surveyed and monitored. Now, quite closely, and those parameters have changed over the last two decades, in particular over the last 5 to 10 years with the advances in imaging, radiology, and MRI scanning. The key thing to this is that you are not compromising the survival of the patient long term. So they are actively being monitored. So you might have a 50-year-old gentleman with a diagnosis of low-grade prostate cancer, and you actively monitor him by way of 6 monthly visits, blood testing, examination, repeat biopsies sometimes, and definitely repeat MRI scans. And if there is any indicator that there is advancement or progression of the tumor, then you intervene with still the opportunity to achieve cure. So you're not compromising the patient's survival.
And you know, Richie, while you're saying that, in my mind, I'm thinking, gosh, you'd want to have a good mindset for that, wouldn't you? Like to be able to.
So there are, yes, absolutely. And I've certainly encountered patients over the last almost two decades now of consultant practice whereby they are absolutely eminently suitable for active surveillance on paper by way of their blood test results, their examination, their X-ray imaging, MRI imaging, or their biopsy showing a low grade. However, psychologically, the patients can't get their heads around it. They're told that they have a diagnosis of cancer and they can't come to terms with living with it and want cure from it. And they want to treat it, whether that be by surgery or radiotherapy. But the role of the prostate cancer specialty nurses, as you well know, Helen, is absolutely crucial in how the diagnosis is delivered and how the patients are counseled afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's really important. And it's not like if you didn't feel comfortable or, you know, you couldn't cope with that kind of treatment option, you know, you can always go back and talk to somebody like yourself, can't you, Richie?
Absolutely.
Not comfortable with that. Yeah.
Like the main risk in treating someone who is suitable for active surveillance is that you're over-treating them. But you counsel the patients on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then like, let's talk about watchful waiting, because that's another category of treatment.
So sometimes people interchange the terms active surveillance and watchful waiting, but they're poles apart. It's not appropriate to interchange them at all. Yeah. Active surveillance, as I've advised or mentioned there and explained, I think quite clearly, is that you're in a treatable age bracket. You can potentially achieve good cure rates, but you're not doing that because you think you're running the risk of over-treatment and the risks of those treatments, which we'll talk about later. But you intervene, if appropriate, down the line without compromising survival. Watchful waiting is whereby you make a diagnosis of prostate cancer in a patient and you decide that it's not appropriate to treat them, irrespective of the grade of the cancer, whether it be a high-grade aggressive cancer or a low-grade cancer, but you are never going to treat them. So watchful waiting is you are destined to palliation down the line if the disease progresses. Now, why would one choose watchful waiting? If you look at the natural history of prostate cancer, and some studies, autopsy studies, would say if all 80-year-old men died and dropped dead in Ireland today, for example, and you did an autopsy on all of their prostates, you would find prostate cancer in an extremely high percentage of those prostates. Some studies would, in the past, have speculated close to 90% of those prostates would have elements of prostate cancer. So therefore, that cancer has evolved in the preceding years and the patients have not died from it. So it gets back to the high incidence of prostate cancer. We all have to die at some stage, not being too philosophical about it, but most men who are diagnosed with prostate cancer in their 70s, for example, will outlive that and they will die of their heart disease or their respiratory disease or their diabetes or something else will get them before their prostate. So that's where watchful waiting comes to play. Now, you may sometimes encounter a patient who, like I was doing kidney transplants this morning with my other surgical hat on, whereby a patient has a compromised overall survival, but they're a younger patient. Maybe they have had another cancer and their survival is guarded, or maybe they have significant heart disease or respiratory disease like pulmonary fibrosis, and they may be in their early 60s. So we use in the past a rough marker or gauge of if you have a life expectancy that is less than 10 years from the diagnosis of your prostate cancer, one would often say the cure for the cancer would be worse than the disease. So therefore, watch and wait.
Yeah. So you're saving.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does actually. And I suppose for our listeners there, you know, that what I'm picking up is that, so if you have less than a 10-year survival with prostate cancer, you're saving that person kind of the side effect profile from treatments.
Yes.
So that makes perfect sense. Yeah.
And there are good treatments. Let's say you've got a 75-year-old gentleman who's diagnosed with a prostate cancer and you feel that, okay, he is likely to outlive that prostate cancer and die from something else. Mm. Not being morbid about things, but that's the light. And you have that discussion with the patient. But if the prostate cancer does progress to secondaries in the bones, there are very good treatments for palliation for it, to maintain a good quality of life. Like I would have innumerable numbers of patients that play 18 holes of golf who are in their late 70s with secondaries from prostate cancer, because the systemic agents or the sort of hormone treatment now has improved an awful lot over the last couple of decades with newer medications, etc.
So, Richie, given that you're the surgical expert here and talking prostate cancer and surgery, there are a number of options, aren't they, in the surgical, modality plan. Will you tell me a little bit about what you do? When you meet a patient first, actually, would be good maybe to start off with.
Yeah, so generally speaking, the patients come through, as I think you've done on a previous episode, the rapid access clinic. They have a diagnosis. Generally, the first person that they will meet with their diagnosis is someone like myself, a prostate cancer surgeon who's manning a rapid access clinic. These are consultant-led clinics in the cancer centres, NCCV centres around the country. And there are prostate cancer specialty nurses that would generally sit in on that initial diagnosis consultation. Ideally, the patient will have a family member with them, or their spouse, or an offspring with them, because as I always say to patients, 4 years are better than two, because when they get that diagnosis, a lot goes in one ear, out the other ear, and then they are given literature to take home, booklets, etc., to read, but it's nice and supportive for them to assimilate the information with someone else by their side. The options are, as we've mentioned already, if they have a low-grade cancer that's favourable, are active surveillance. Then after that, we're talking to them. If we feel that it's a cancer that needs treatment, or they choose that they want to have treatment for the cancer for whatever reason, broadly speaking, you have two options, surgery or radiotherapy. Again, broadly speaking, and not being biased about things, obviously I would be a little bit inherently biased as I'm a surgeon. Mm-hmm. If you take two Mr. X's or Joe Bloggs and they have a diagnosis of a intermediate grade prostate cancer and they need treatment for their prostate cancer, if one of them goes with radiotherapy primarily or one of them goes with surgery, their 5, 10, 15-year cancer-specific survival is fairly comparable in the international literature. So a lot of the decision-making boils down to personal preference for the patient or how they are counseled. By and large, younger patients, and what I mean by that is generally men in their 40s or 50s or early 60s, would opt for surgery. The seesaw would lean that way, whereas men in their 60s, early 70s would tend to sway towards radiotherapy. Now, there's a few reasons for that. And that would, there are always exceptions to the rule. And indeed, I only was performing a radical prostatectomy on a 37-year-old gentleman there 3 months ago, which is extraordinarily young, with a significant family history. And he actually initially, he wasn't suitable for active surveillance. He wanted to have radiotherapy. Now, I'll explain to you, most radiation oncologists would also agree, if you are young, and what we mean by that is under the age of 50, radiotherapy, yes, may cure your cancer, but you are subjecting yourself to latent side effects from radiotherapy, which can happen 10 years later. So yeah. The nice thing, in my view, about surgery for the younger men is that, you know, you're getting out the primary cancer. Hopefully, if you get all things right, 90% of patients have a long-term cancer-free survival afterwards. But if it has gone through the edge of the prostate or if it has spread, you find that out. And you're keeping a sub on the bench because they can have additional treatment by way of radiotherapy to the prostate bed where the prostate used to sit, or to lymph nodes in the region of the prostate or higher up in the tummy. If you do have radiotherapy as your primary modality of treatment, it is extraordinarily difficult to embark upon removing the prostate down the line if there is a failure from the radiotherapy. But we don't like talking about failures of surgical treatment when we're giving the initial diagnosis. So you have to sort of work around that with the patient. Yeah. So as regards to different types of surgery, then if we hone in on that, I suppose when I was away in fellowship training 17 years ago, before I went to Australia 18 years ago, it was all open radical prostates. So it was done by open surgery. It was a cut in the lower part of the tummy, straight down, a vertical cut. The surgery took about 2.5 hours and a very successful operation. Now, there was physiological issues with the surgery as regards blood loss. The average blood loss in international series would have been around 700 mils of blood. The hospital stay was around 5 to 7 days on average. Things then progressed and open surgical techniques did improve also. But laparoscopic surgery or keyhole surgery evolved. Now, keyhole laparoscopic surgery was at the forefront in France, in India, and in North America also. But then very rapidly, robotic surgery came on the scene. And this is Da Vinci or robotic surgery, and there are new robots being developed at the moment and will soon be commercially available. But Da Vinci or Intuitive developed a robot, and it has transformed the management, surgical management of prostate cancer. And in fact, probably I would say, as an estimate, I can't be held to this, but I would say about 90% of radical prostates performed in the Republic of Ireland today are performed robotically. Sadly, it was only available in the private system for about 10 years, but now over the last 5 years, it has become widely available in all the public NCCP hospitals also, which is very good for the patient population of Ireland.
So it's been around for about 15 years in Ireland, has it, Richard?
It has, yes, yeah.
Yeah. And tell me, like, I'm inquisitive now and curious, really, when you're saying that, how, you know, like robots and people, robots versus consultants, it must have been a little bit of a shift in the mind, was it, to accept that a robot, but with a surgeon behind it doing your surgery.
Yeah, so it's a tool. Essentially, it's just a different, you're using different tools. So the surgeon sits at a console. It's a 3D console. They have their head immersed in it. After creating a sort of a surgical field by inserting cannulas, trocars, a camera into the patient's abdomen. And then you have a bedside assistant that will change instruments, but the surgeon then unscrubs from the patient and sits at this console and operates for the approximately 2-2.5 hours of the surgery. What it has led to is faster recoveries, faster return to daily activities of the patients, and a lower blood loss rate. As regards better oncological outcomes, it depends on the surgeon's volume, the surgeon's expertise, but you can have equally as successfully an oncological or cancer cure rate, whether it's done by open surgery or robotic surgery.
Yeah, and it sounds like a very successful option, doesn't it?
It is. As regards men, in particular, men in their 50s and 60s that are still working and want to get back to their daily activities faster, it has transformed that for them, yes.
Yeah. So my next big question then, Richie, is really around what we sometimes call the unwanted effects of surgery, whatever they may be. I know like erectile dysfunction is one, incontinence is another. You've already mentioned cancer control, I guess. I know from even talking to patients myself that cancer control is the ultimate. But then what follows from that, you know, and shortening of the penis as well is something that's often kind of mentioned or thought about?
So there are lots of complications associated with any surgery, and we do give patients booklets, and they go through the nuances of the sort of more what we call significant complications, but low likelihood of them happening or a very low risk of them happening. We talk about the trifecta, sort of what you want to achieve with surgery for prostate cancer or indeed radiotherapy. So number one there, and it is the number one priority for the patient when they sit in front of you and they've decided they want to go and have treatment. Yes, they've agreed to it. They accept it. They don't do the ostrich and bury their head in the sand, which some patients do, but you've counseled them, say, yes, I accept this diagnosis. I'll have my treatment. So the number one priority for them and indeed their partners usually is cancer cure, cancer control. So that's the number one of the trifecta. And yes, we do have exceptionally good cancer cure rates with surgery for prostate cancer if they're surgical candidates. The second thing then is what we talk about to patients generally in my clinic, I would list as number two, would be incontinence, urinary leakage. Now, back in the, what would I say, olden days, back 20 to 30 years ago, approximately, and this is not being in any way disingenuous to my retired colleagues or whatever, but like radical prostate surgery actually only started in Ireland back in the early to mid 1990s. So it came out of North America, the US, United States in the early 90s. But approximately 10% of patients needed additional measures and treatments down the line for incontinence of urine. Now with better improved surgical techniques, understanding of the anatomy, etc., that risk of incontinence has reduced significantly. And if I'm sitting in front of a patient, like I will be tomorrow morning in my rapid access prostate clinic, and counseling him about the chances of incontinence of urine, I will say to him that my own personal studies, auditing of our, it's a 3% risk. So okay. 3 out of every 100 men that I operate on will, at 6 to 12 months down the line after a surgery, not have regained good control over their urination. So what does that mean? That can mean that, unfortunately, they are leaking urine constantly, which is very, very rare, or they still require incontinence pads, whereby when they cough, they sneeze, do some exercise, they require to wear a pad. Like I've had patients, I've had a professional tennis player that I've operated on, and he wears a pad when he goes back playing tennis. Other than that, he does not wear a pad at all for any other daily activities. So I've had a gentleman who's a professional musician who plays a wind instrument. And, you know, you're putting significant pressure on your pelvic floor because men are not reliant on their pelvic floor for continence. But after having a radical prostatectomy, they in some part become more reliant on their pelvic floor. And that's the sort of the simplest way of explaining it to patients. Ladies tend to understand it better. I know in some countries, men go for pelvic floor exercises, like in Holland, in some of the cancer, the prostate cancer center, preoperatively, so that they know what they wish to achieve afterwards in their rehabilitation of the and incontinence. Pilates classes, physiotherapy afterwards, these all assist tremendously in men regaining control over their continence afterwards. But happily, it's a good story. 97% of men will be pad-free about 6 to 12 months after their surgery or expect to be pad-free.
That's great. That's good to hear, isn't it? Richie, while you were talking there, can I just go back to, can you explain why that incontinence happens, just for our listeners?
So the prostate helps with incontinence, and I generally, when I'm talking to patients, I draw a little caricature of it. So you're removing the prostate in its entirety. It's a gland. It can be the size of a mandarin. It can be a little bit smaller. It can be bigger. And you're detaching it from the bladder and from the sort of base of the penis. And at the base of the penis at that level, you've got your external sphincter. So that can become damaged where you're cutting the prostate off, and then you're rejoining it onto the bladder neck. But you've sort of disrupted your continence mechanism temporarily there is the best and simplest way of describing it. It's easier to describe it if you actually draw a diagram. And most of the booklets to do with prostate cancer surgery will have these diagrams there.
Okay. And that makes sense, because sometimes it's good to know why it happens, isn't it?
Absolutely. And then an understanding after. Patients who are, I'm very particular about getting patients to attend programs such as the Xwell program, things like that, because their motivation, and we know that exercise benefits patients psychologically. We know it benefits them after a significant traumatic diagnosis, whether that be cancer or something else in their life. And we know that increased weight in patients, as in their high body mass index, does impede their continence in recovery after surgery. If you've got a very large abdomen, it's putting more pressure on your pelvic floor, so you're more likely to have what we call stress urinary incontinence. Yeah. Now, there are surgical ways of managing it if it does occur, in those few cases that it does occur.
Yeah. And I had some lots of information from Wemi, who was one of your physiotherapists at Beaumont. And it's really useful as well, I think, for listeners to know that there are other disciplines out there that will help, you know, to manage the incontinence too, aren't there, to help with recovery?
Absolutely. As in the ancillary, like attending sort of Pilates classes, attending physiotherapy, like it was way back, actually, well before Wemi's time, when I came back from Australia. First of all, it was actually a real change in mindset. You may be recall a lady called Cindy Cusack.
Yes.
So Cindy sort of approached myself when I came back, and I was a young consultant, and she thought, what do you think, would Irish men actually get together in a group and talk about something as, what would I say, personal as incontinence or erectile dysfunction, which we haven't mentioned thus far. And because of, demands on manpower and et cetera, Cindy decided that she would implement a group class. So she might have 4 or 5 or 6 men sitting together. And that still continues now. Obviously, with the pandemic, it wasn't possible. But men actually found solace and found great support in being with other men that were going through the same, and they were at different stages of the journey afterwards, because most men in the initial stages after the surgery will have a degree of incontinence, but most men it'll rapidly recur. So it's great if a man is sitting there and he said, well, I'm only 3 weeks after my surgery, and this man is sort of 7 weeks after, and he said, well, it was bad at 3 weeks, but it's much better now. And they can talk to one another. So that was a bit of a change in mindset for Irish men, but it has worked very well.
And it's very empowering, as you say, to have, you know, men together and know that there are improvements ahead. Yeah. You know, it's hopeful. It gives a lot of hope, doesn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Richie, you mentioned erectile dysfunction there. So we'll come to that. What's your experience of that post-surgery?
So it's quite difficult to equate, even though we do sort of questionnaires on patients preoperatively and postoperatively to try and audit it. It's a very, very important aspect of the management of prostate cancer. It doesn't tend to be a high priority for the vast majority of men when they get that initial shock and that diagnosis. But it's important to discuss it.
Yeah.
Some men say, oh, no, listen, I just want my cancer cured. And I want to be continent, because that can be very disruptive in their daily activities. But their potency then tends to be a sort of a low priority for a lot of men, not all men, a low priority at that time of diagnosis and deciding on treatment. Sadly, and it's very important, again, I'm a little bit skeptical of some of the literature on it, and you will read some reports of, we've got a 90% potency recovery rate. You will see on some sort of, hospital or surgical clinic sites from some developed countries around the world. But they're trying to demand and drum up business, and you have to be quite careful of it. What I say to patients is, certainly your erections will only be worse afterwards. They can't be better. They can't be better. The greatest predictor, in my experience, is how are their erections as we sit here before their surgery. The durability of their erection, the longevity of their erection has reduced in 50% of men over the age of 50 in the general population. So it's important to ascertain when a man is being guided about his surgical treatment for prostate cancer, how are your erections to start off with?
Yeah.
As I've said already, not to repeat myself too much, certainly they will only potentially disimprove afterwards. If you're talking to a patient who's aged in their 50, so a young man with a diagnosis of organ-confined prostate cancer, whereby you can strive to achieve a nerve-sparing surgery, which we are quite radical about doing, attempting to do nerve-sparing surgery in men who want to maintain their erections, where it's the cancer allows you to do it, so it's organ-confined. I tell patients they've got about a 70% chance of regaining, so that's 70% chance of regaining spontaneous erectile function over the following 2 years.
Yeah.
Sometimes if the cancer does not allow it, whereby they've got locally advanced prostate cancer, or you know on clinical findings preoperatively, whether that be on an MRI scan or on the basis of the finger examination, you suspect the cancer has gone through the capsule or the skin of the prostate, you would not there in those situations attempt to spare the nerves, because you may be compromising their cancer cure success rates. Does that make sense?
I'm sure they wouldn't want you to do that anyway. Yes,
absolutely.
Course,
absolutely.
Yeah.
So it is a very, it's probably the main long-lasting side effect associated with treatment, in particular surgical treatment for prostate cancer. But it's not all doom and gloom. As I said, if you can do nerve-sparing surgery and the appropriate candidates, 70% of these men who have good preoperative erections will regain good spontaneous erections afterwards with the assistance of medications such as sildenafil, etc. And oral medications have a huge role to play in the post-operative recovery, or what we call penile rehabilitation.
Yeah. And we have Ger Boyle is coming to talk to us in episode 4 about, you know, all the treatment options available. So
very good.
That's really useful to hear, Richie. And one thing I would say as well, having been that nurse specialist too, is it's so important for men to know about all of these unwanted effects pre-surgery, isn't it? It's part of the consent. So it's informed consent. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I do feel that once men know about these and it's not a surprise to them afterwards, and they've kind of had that thought, you know, in their head and accepted that it might happen to them, that they cope much better anyway. So Richie, I think you've pretty much said it there. And one of my final questions to you would be, you know, do you see this as a man's disease or is it a relationship disease? But I think you've pretty much answered that for me in a fairly holistic way.
I know it's really important. And I know when a patient is sort of getting their follow-up appointment, the thing they don't want to hear is, is your wife available or is your partner available to come in with you? They know the writing is on the wall when they hear that. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but it is hugely important, and it can't be underestimated, the 4 years as opposed to 2 years, and you know, the support that they can get, because it is a life-changing event for patients. Yeah.
So on that note, Richie, I'm going to maybe ask you one final question, and that would be what your big take-home message for your listeners is today.
Okay, so my big take-home message is, don't do the ostrich on it. Be proactive about one's health. Don't get sort of, how would I say, fixated on having your PSA checked every 3 months or every 6 months. But at the same time, I see patients every week who haven't ever had their PSA checked. And they may be in their 60s. So my advice would be, have your cholesterol checked, have your blood pressure checked, and have your PSA checked with your GP. It is important. It's how you interpret the result more so than what the result means as regards. It's not the absolute value. People look at this PSA and they say, oh, the number is 4. That's abnormal. That might be normal for you. It might be abnormal for someone else. So do be proactive and have your PSA checked with your GP. And then if appropriate, the GP will refer you on to a rapid access clinic. Having your PSA checked and it being slightly abnormal, does not necessarily mean you have prostate cancer at all. In fact, the majority of men that attend our rapid access clinics with an abnormal PSA don't have prostate cancer.
Yeah. So, Richie, it's been a privilege to have you with us today.
You're welcome.
And we're going to hear from Jared next. So thank you so much.
Not at all. Take care. Bye-bye.
Hi, Jared. It's great to have you here with us today talking prostate cancer on our podcast series.
Thanks, so, Helen. Lovely to see you again after a few years.
I know.
We used to work together in Vincent's a few years ago.
We had a great working relationship, and we had great a process going for patients with prostate cancer, didn't we?
That's right. Yeah. Great collaboration.
Yeah. So, Jared, just to, I suppose, introduce you, you're a consultant radiotherapist and you work at Vincent's.
And St. Luke's Hospital.
Okay. And you've been there for about 12 years?
I've been there since 2010. Prior to that, I worked in the UK in a place called the Royal Marsden Hospital in London.
Yeah.
And prior to that, I did my training in radiation oncology in St. Luke's in Rathgar. Prior to that, I worked in Bournemouth Hospital.
Great. So lots of expertise coming to the table. So, Jared, I suppose, I mean, the first and the most simple question I'd ask you is, when does a patient get to see you?
When anybody is diagnosed with prostate cancer in St. Vincent's Hospital, they're seen by a surgeon and by a radiation oncologist. So every patient who has prostate cancer gets the option of seeing a radiation oncologist. They're initially diagnosed by the surgeon, but then they see a radiation oncologist. Mm. And in St. Vincent's, for some patients, we have a joint clinic, so they may meet the urologist and then they hang on for, you know, a short period of time, then I would meet them as well. So I meet most patients who have prostate cancer in St. Vincent's together with a colleague of mine who also works in St. Vincent's.
Okay. And I guess at this point, like, they've been through the multidisciplinary team process.
Yes. So anybody who's diagnosed initially, when their samples are taken, when they have a biopsy, that's checked by a doctor who's called a pathologist, and then that's reviewed at an MDT, or multidisciplinary meeting.
Yeah.
And so they would all be going through the multidisciplinary meeting. And then at different points or different stages of their treatments, their cases or their files would be rediscussed at an MDT, and that's quite common.
Yeah, I think it's so reassuring as well for patients, you know. A lot of patients don't necessarily know about the MDT, so we're emphasising it here, you know, that...
Okay.
They are discussed, and core members, there's lots of core members involved.
Yes, there are. We have, so you'd have a radiologist, that's the doctor who looks at the images. Mm. You have a pathologist, that's the doctor who looks or makes the diagnosis of the cancer. You have the urologist, which is the surgical doctor. You have ourselves, radiation oncologist. You have medical oncologist. You have nursing staff. Sometimes you have dietitians. And of course, you have coordinators.
Mm.
So it's a broad team.
Yeah. Great. So not only one person making a decision, but a lot of experts making decisions.
Yeah, it's a group decision.
Yeah.
A lot of the time you don't need everybody's input because the decision is self-evident. But sometimes you would need the expertise of others to see is such and such appropriate or not.
Yeah. I think that's really reassuring for patients and their families, for everybody really, isn't it?
Mm.
And I guess... something that comes up every now and again is, like, you know, a man with prostate cancer, somebody who's born with a prostate, and they're given, you know, the treatment options. It could be surgery, it could be radiotherapy, it could be active surveillance.
Yeah.
How difficult is that for patients, and how difficult is it for you as the radiotherapist talking to them?
I think it's extremely difficult for patients, and sometimes, you know, a lot of times you would talk to a patient and then at the end of the consultation, they say, well, what would you do?
Mm-hmm.
Or they'd say to you, well, it would be much easier if somebody could just tell me what to do. And and commonly, or I would jokingly say to the patient, well, when we tell you what to do, people don't like it. So a lot of the time the decision, and I think the urologists in St. Vincent's, where I work, that explain to patients that you do have a choice to make, and it is largely up to yourselves. So then if you get into that type of a conversation with a patient, I would often say the outcomes in terms of effectiveness or treatment are broadly speaking the same for most patients. But the side effect profiles are different between surgical treatment and non-surgical treatment, be it external beam radiation or be it with brachytherapy. And so what I say to patients is consider the side effects that have been discussed with you, review the information booklets, and then opt for the treatment that you feel you'd be most comfortable with if you were unfortunate to get the side effects that have been discussed with you.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good way to go.
Yeah, I think informed decision making, yeah, really. And I suppose we're learning more and more that prostate cancer is not just a disease or, you know, something that affects the person with the cancer, but it affects their partners,
it does,
family as well. Do you see men alone or do you encourage their partners to come along and have those conversations?
My preference is to see a patient with another person,
yeah,
be it a partner, sibling, friend, yeah, somebody.
Yeah.
I think it's much better. And I think if the patients are in a relationship, it's better that that other significant person is in the room when you're having the chat, because it's not just a diagnosis that affects the patient sitting in front of you. It affects other people,
and
maybe another significant person. So it's very important that people understand that I think people should always bring somebody to the consultation. Yeah.
So shared decision making.
Yeah, that's always been my preference.
Yeah. Okay. And then Gerard, I suppose we'll home in on the treatments. Okay.
Yeah.
So you're specialized in radiotherapy, and you mentioned external beam radiotherapy, and you mentioned brachytherapy. So let's talk about, you know, somebody who comes into you with prostate cancer. Now, we've learned about the stages and the grades and the Gleason scoring of prostate cancer in episode one. But I suppose just to learn from you what you offer to a specific type of patient with prostate cancer.
So if you take an imaginary person who is in their early 60s or mid 60s, and they indeed, largely speaking, at any age, if they have a diagnosis of prostate cancer, the questions that I ask the patients are, do they have any other medical problems? Sometimes patients who have other medical illnesses could preclude one treatment or other. I would also ask the patients about their urinary symptoms. So if they're getting up an awful lot of times at night, if they have an awful lot of irritation passing water, if they have to hurry to go to the toilet. My own view would be, for a lot of those patients, they'd be better served to have an operation, because radiation in all its different forms can exacerbate those problems.
Right.
So I'd always ask about their urinary status first. And then if we bring it forward and the patient is interested to consider external beam radiotherapy, which is probably the most common treatment, the default position for most patients is that we can now offer the treatment over 4 weeks.
Okay.
And that is a change in the last number of years, because previously, when I was training and when I was starting as a consultant, the standard treatment would be for 8 weeks.
Yeah.
And the reason we're able to treat patients over a shorter period of time is that's based on clinical trials. So there was a large, predominantly UK trial, which compared the prolonged course of treatment versus a shorter course of treatment over 4 weeks. And we know that 4 weeks is just as good as 8 weeks.
Yeah.
So then I would explain to the patient what that involves. So you would explain to them that initially, before they start their treatment, they'd have to have a scan in the hospital where they're going to have their treatment. And the purpose of that scan is to input their anatomy into a computer so that we can design their treatment. And then typically a few weeks after that, they'd start their course of treatment. And that treatment would be Monday to Friday, 5 days a week. The treatment itself takes 4 or 5 minutes. It does, you know, they don't feel it, they don't see it, they're not sick, they're not unwell, they won't lose their hair. But there is a slight, there's more to the process insofar as we'd ask them to drink a lot of water.
Yeah.
And patients jokingly would talk about the water torture after the several weeks of treatment. So that all in all, when you arrive at a hospital, leave the hospital again, it takes about an hour and a half each day for about 4 weeks.
Yeah.
And you'd explain to the patients about the side effects that can occur. There are side effects that can occur during treatment. There are side effects that settle down, and then there may be some side effects that can develop, you know, months to years after treatment. But for most patients, the urinary and the bowel side effects settle down. There are, of course, patients who have got side effects, and you explain that to them and you provide them an information booklet. There are some patients who, in addition to their radiotherapy treatment, they would have an indication or a reason that we'd discuss anti-hormonal treatment with them. And you'd explain the purpose of that anti-hormonal treatment is it lowers a man's testosterone level, and largely what differentiates males and females. And you explain the side effects that go with the anti-hormonal treatment. And
what are they, Jared? Could you
sure,
talk them through?
They're so virtually every man gets a degree of hot flushes and sweats. They typically kick in about 4 to 6 weeks after after the onset of the treatment. And if, for example, a patient is having the anti-hormonal treatment for 6 months, I think it's important that they understand that the duration of side effects could be up to a year. So they could have hot flushes and sweats for up to a year. Also, they tend to put on weight. They tend to put on weight mostly around their midriff. And largely that's got to do with the redistribution of fat.
Yeah.
They lose a bit of muscle strength. So if they're walkers or runners, they'll notice a difference. They're not so strong. But it's a small degree of muscle wastage, but it does happen.
Now, it doesn't sound that inviting to me and probably to listeners. So is it something that kind of they you know, after a period of time, they can regain?
Do regain. But I think it's important for them to understand it from the outset.
Absolutely.
Rather than experiencing these symptoms. Yeah. And if they didn't know what's going to happen, it can be oftentimes more distressing.
Yeah, I agree.
Also, with the anti-hormonal treatment, they lose their libido and erectile function as well.
We're going to talk about that in more detail in an episode further on. We'll help help people to understand that, I think, and it's really, really important because it's looking at survivorship and and allowing people to live their best quality of life. Mm-hmm. So Jared, we've talked about the external beam radiotherapy and. Gosh, medicine moves on, doesn't it? Like we've moved from 8 weeks to 4 weeks, which is actually huge improvement in
expectations. And there's scope to move it shorter again.
Right, okay.
There are some patients are suitable for what's called stereotactic treatment. And that's where patients can be treated over a much shorter period of time. Maybe have the treatment over 5 days.
Mm.
Not every patient is suitable for it, but there are select groups of patients who are suitable to have a stereotactic treatment.
Okay, that's very fine.
It's a high dose of radiation given to the area that we want to treat. It's usually over about 5 to 7 treatments.
Okay. Now, Jared, I know you had an operating theatre this morning, for yourself, and you carried out a couple of brachytherapy sessions. So tell me a little bit about that.
That's another treatment option for men who have what we call low risk or intermediate risk prostate cancer. And what that involves for the patient is it's a general anesthetic. They come in the morning and they're given some medications to clean out their bowels. They're put asleep. The procedure takes about an hour and a half. They go home typically that afternoon. They go home without a tube in their bladder, so there's no catheter. And I think the difference between the brachytherapy and external beam radiotherapy is the patients tend to have more acute urinary side effects. So they'll go to the bathroom more frequently, both during the day and at nighttime. They may have discomfort going to the toilet. They may have to hurry to go to the bathroom. But we give the patients medications to help combat those symptoms. And then what I typically say to patients a month after the procedure, 50% of patients have symptoms, 50% don't. 4 months after the procedure, I would say 80% of patients have little in the way of symptoms, 20% do. And at a year, I'd say there's maybe less than 5% of patients would have some degree of ongoing urinary symptoms.
Okay. And so we've now kind of covered external beam radiotherapy. We've fine-tuned it down to brachytherapy, to stereotactic radiotherapy. There's such a thing as CyberKnife therapy. What's that?
CyberKnife is a brand name of a type of a unit that delivers stereotactic treatment. So CyberKnife is stereotactic treatment.
Okay.
So
in essence,
so it's the same thing.
It's offered in Ireland, is it?
It's offered in Ireland.
Okay. And I've seen on social media recently surface
surface guided radiotherapy.
Yeah.
And
what is that?
That so historically, patients, or commonly patients still in a lot of centres in the country, they have the little permanent marks put on their skin or tattoos.
Mm.
And the purpose of those marks is to ensure that the patients are lying in the correct position every day for treatment. Now, with surface-guided radiotherapy, which has been present in St. Vincent's for the last 3 years, there's no tattoos, so there's no permanent marks.
Mm.
And so that's an advantage because the tattoos may be distressing for some people. But more than that, sometimes when we ask patients to hold their breath, for example, when they're having certain types of chest radiotherapy or a radiotherapy to their tummy areas, they worry about the duration of time that they're able to hold their breath for. But with the surface-guided tracking device, if the patient moves more than out of a small tolerance, the machine just cuts out.
Okay.
So there's a safety element to it.
Yeah.
So it's very useful, and I think it's be available shortly in the St. Luke's network as well.
Oh, great. So medicine moving on again,
It's moving on, but it's been present there for a while.
Yeah. Okay, we're hearing more about it now, I guess.
Yeah, it's been publicised a bit more.
Yeah. Okay, so Gerard, I know I'm going to be talking to a couple of patient advocates in a few episodes later. And one of those gentlemen he's probably had two treatment modalities. He's had surgery and then histologically had a positive margin. And he went on to have neoadjuvant hormone therapy with radiotherapy. So, and he classified it as a positive margin. Do you see many patients in that kind of category or classification?
It's not uncommon.
Okay.
I think the surgeons will explain to patients it's a possibility.
Mm.
It's not an uncommon possibility. It's important for people to understand it's not a failure of their treatment.
No. Yeah.
And it depends. So some patients may have just maybe one or two cells at the margin.
Yeah.
And they would have their PSA checked. And if the PSA starts to rise, you'd initiate treatment. And that's probably the most common scenario that we, even if there is a positive margin, we would check the PSA. And if the PSA begins to rise at the earliest time point, then we'd initiate treatment. And the treatment that we initiate is external beam radiotherapy plus anti-hormonal treatment.
Yeah.
And the dose that we give is slightly lower than the dose we give if the prostate was intact, if they hadn't had surgery previously. And commonly the duration of hormones would be about 6 months. Though sometimes if there are other risk features, like there are abnormal lymph nodes present when the surgical doctor does the operation, we would give anti-hormonal treatment for a longer period of time. We're talking 2 to 3 years.
And you're down-regulating the tumour activity by doing that? Is that what that means? Or
I think I would go even simpler than that. We have proof based on randomised trials that have demonstrated benefit for adding hormones to radiation, that it makes the radiation work that bit better, decrease the chance of it coming back.
Okay.
And that's the reason I would discuss to the patient.
Okay, brilliant. So I suppose before I move on to another topic, I just want to maybe tie up, you know, the treatments that you have offered to your patient group and the kind of follow-up process. What does that look like?
Okay, so during treatment, treatments are slightly different because we're still in the COVID era. But if maybe pre-COVID, patients would be seen in our clinics maybe every couple of weeks, or they'd be offered a review every couple of weeks during the course of their treatment. During COVID, it's largely by telephone, or they would call into a clinic that's available if they need it. And then all patients would have a review 6 weeks after their treatment. And then, largely speaking, I see everybody about 4 months after that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I generally ask patients to have their PSAs checked periodically, usually on a 6-monthly basis. Depending on how patients are doing and depending on their underlying risk factors, one would review them every 6 months for the first maybe year or two.
Mm.
And then what I find myself doing is asking patients to have their blood test done with their general practitioner if possible. Or when in the hospital, get their bloods done, send them in. And we would just probably see them once a year. As long as they get their blood test done every 6 months and there's no real active problems, then we don't burden them with additional hospital visits. But they'll be reviewed at a minimum up to 5 years.
Okay. And so it's regular PSAs?
PSA is the main.
And what's your expectation? What do you expect that PSA to do if, treatment has worked very well and is potentially curable?
So for a patient who are just treating their prostate and they haven't had a surgical treatment previously, explain to the patient, we want your PSA to be low.
Okay.
If they're on anti-hormonal treatment, patients typically notice that their PSA becomes undetectable. And then as the effects of the anti-hormonal treatment wears off, the PSA can rise slightly, but we still want it to be low.
Mm-hmm.
We would have a preference, the lower the better, really. But less than one, we're usually comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But to put it in context, if a patient was in a randomized trial or sort of in a major study, one would not be concerned or deem it a concern unless their PSA rose above two.
Okay.
So we'd like the main goal is that we want it low.
Yeah.
Whereas if a patient has had their prostate removed, they want the PSA to be zero. The reason there's a difference is that all prostate tissue is gone after you have your prostate removed. But after you've had radiotherapy, you'll have some functioning normal prostate cancer, normal prostate cells there.
Yeah.
That's why you have a small bit of PSA, and that's fine.
Yeah, that's expected.
Yeah.
Okay. So sometimes the PSA kind of promotes quite a bit of stress, doesn't it? In terms of knowing what it is, and especially in the initial phases, I think, where I suppose, people need to become confident with the treatment they've had and see that PSA go down.
But also it can be tricky because, most people these days look up the internet and they see PSA is not, it's not a fantastic test to diagnose cancer.
Oh, yeah.
So we know that.
Yeah.
But I try and explain to the patient that after you've had treatment, it's an excellent test to demonstrate the effectiveness of a treatment. And also as a good early warning marker of anything that's going amiss. So if your PSA starts to trend upwards, that's an early warning or a useful early warning sign of potential trouble.
Yeah, so for our listeners, PSA shouldn't be deemed as that kind of anxiety state while waiting for it. It's a real indication that you've been looked after well and monitored in a very close level.
And it's an early warning marker.
Yeah. Early warning marker. I think that's really important. And Gerard, I wanted to ask you about, palliative radiotherapy. In a few episodes on, we were talking to John Wall, who presented at 46 with stage 4 prostate cancer. And really, I know radiotherapy is a very important treatment and is available in Ireland for men who present with late stage prostate cancer. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Radiotherapy is hugely useful for any patient with a cancer diagnosis who needs it to palliate symptoms. It's effective, it's inexpensive, and it works really well. And for most patients, or for a lot of patients, they can have maybe one treatment or maybe no more than 4 or 5 treatments, which is very good at getting rid of pain. And if you take a scenario, for example, of a male patient with prostate cancer, which is spread to a bone and the bone is causing pain, once it's diagnosed as being a metastasis or a spread, then the person can get radiotherapy. And then for most patients, the pain is gone within 2 or 3 weeks of the treatment.
Mm.
So it's really effective.
Yeah. Good to know that, isn't it?
And a lot less side effects than a lot of drugs that people need to take for pain relief.
And that's over a couple of, is it over a week or over a couple of weeks?
It could be one session or it could be 4 or 5 sessions.
Okay.
And very, very, very rarely you may have treatment which is a little longer than that, but that's uncommon.
Okay. So I guess, stage 4 can be quite a shocking diagnosis. We don't see it as much. Is that changing? Is that trend changing a little bit at the moment, Gerard, or...?
Unfortunately, we do see patients who they're diagnosed late in their illness.
Mm.
And I think it's probably less common than what it was many years ago. And part of the reason for that is that a lot of patients with their GPs are getting PSAs checked and then they're ultimately getting diagnosed. So I think there are less patients who are diagnosed with stage four prostate cancer, but you still get plenty of patients.
Yeah.
But you try and manage them as the chronic illness, with all the various modalities, with medical oncology, with ourselves, sometimes with the surgical doctors as well.
Yeah. We're going to talk to a medical oncologist after this. Yeah. So yeah, it's really good to get input from all, you know, specialists within the core multidisciplinary team. There's one thing that struck me there, Jared, when we were talking about, you know, bone metastases are spread. Do you talk to your patients about any oncological risks that might need to know about?
Well, I think for a patient I would like to think that because they're having their PSA checked, that we're quite likely to pick up, say, a bone metastasis in their spine before it leads to the symptom of cord compression.
Yeah. Okay.
When you do have patients and you're looking after patients and they have spread in their bones and they understand that, you explain to them what the symptoms could be, so that if they had, for example, maybe a change in sensation or of a tingling sensation in their arms or their legs, or they have difficulty with their waterworks or with their bowels or change in their muscle strength, that'd be important to go to an emergency department to be evaluated. So you would let the patients who have the diagnosis know what the warning symptoms are, yes.
Okay, and that's good, because I know it's very specific to, it's very individual to patients, but it's good to know that they're aware of the possibility and, you know, act on it if necessary.
And not just for spinal cord compression. If you have a patient and their PSA is going up and you explain to them that there's a possibility that the prostate cancer cells could go to different parts of the body, and you explain to them what symptoms to look out for, like pain.
Mm.
And it's not like a pain where you have a pain in your shoulder one day and it could be in your wrist the next day. It's pain that doesn't go away with simple remedies. That's the type of pain that needs to be evaluated.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and do you refer people on to the palliative care team?
All the time.
All the time. That's good to hear. Early referral or at a point? At what point?
You develop, I think, a rapport with patients, and you understand that patients need more than the care that we are expert in providing, and how we commonly introduce it as sort of for symptom control.
Yeah.
So palliative care, I think, when I was training, it was there were very few. For example, there's a broader group who provide a service now. And I think you try and introduce it to patients at an earlier time point in their illness, when they have a non-curable illness, and explain the benefits. And you get a sense from patients if they'd like to explore it, or if people shy away, then you can leave well enough alone. And what I do is I explain to their GPs through my letter that I've introduced the concept, and they were not interested, and go from there.
Yeah. And I think really just to emphasize what we're talking about here, Jared, you mentioned that palliative care is about symptom management. It's not necessarily about end of life, which I think is a misunderstanding that many people have. And the whole idea around palliative care is to improve people's quality of life and actually to reduce those levels of pain if they're there, and to manage symptoms in a more effective way so that people can get on with their lives and live their best lives.
Yes.
Yeah, so on that note, Jared, it's been fantastic talking to you today. And I suppose I always ask, what's your strong message today for our listeners?
My strong message are for those who are diagnosed to hopefully they get a good consultation with the various specialists who are looking after them. And when they're choosing their treatment, I would think of it more of consider the side effects rather than one treatment is better than the other.
Yeah.
And then help. And that probably is the best way to make their decision. And then for patients who have later stage disease, be mindful of symptoms. And because there's plenty of treatment available that can be quick and easy and resolve their problem and help them to live as good a life as they can live.
So talking about their cancer.
Yes.
Yeah. Openly.
Very
honestly.
Yes. If possible, bring somebody when you come into a consultation.
Yeah.
I think that's very important.
Really important, yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with you. So, Jared, thanks for your expertise, your time, and your passion for what you do.
Thank you.
It's fantastic.
Thanks,
Helen. I'd like to introduce Dr. Wasim Darvish, who is a consultant medical oncologist at the Mater University Hospital in Dublin. He obtained his Bachelor of Medicine from Aden University, Yemen, in 2004. During his medical oncology training in Ireland, Wasim completed his MD in Advanced Medical Oncology from the University of Bonn in Germany and a Diploma of Lung Cancer from the University of Zurich. His special interests include genitory urinary cancer, and that's why you're here with us today, Wasim. So you're very welcome and delighted to be able to talk to you.
Hi, Helen. Hi, everyone.
Wasim, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule. I know how it is on the front line these days. It's very difficult at the moment post-COVID or even in COVID still, but you're very welcome. Thank you for taking the time to provide us with some information and expertise. Talking to you, obviously, about medical oncology here. And again, Wasim, for our listeners, I'd love you to explain to us what medical oncology means and when a patient would get to see you.
Okay, so hi everyone, and thank you for having me. It's my pleasure to be here. So medical oncology in prostate cancer is part of the multidisciplinary team. So usually there is a urologist, he's the first person to look after our patient and to diagnose him. Then there is a radiation oncologist where usually they will help, and the medical oncology part, it's, you know, just part of it. And they can't divide it, you know. Usually we will be involved from the early stage, discussing the case at the multidisciplinary team, giving our opinion. Then at one stage, we'll see the patient either for just follow-up or maybe to introduce any systemic treatment in the future.
So have trends changed somewhat then, Wasim? Years ago, medical oncologists were specialists and saw patients almost at the end of their journey when other treatments failed. It seems like the whole trend has changed, has it?
Exactly, Helen. Like, till a few years ago, the role of medical oncology will wait until the cancer starts to spread. And we know now that's totally wrong, because the only chance of cure, if you will treat the patient before, like if the prostate cancer is still localized and no symptoms, once it's spread, that's not a cure, just that to try to control it. Then what happened for later on, we came in at the stage where there is a chemical relapse. That means we can see the PSA in the blood, but there is no cancer on the scan. Then nowadays, like especially from last September, during last ASCO or ESMO, that's an International Oncology Cancer Society meeting, we have an evidence that to be early there and to put your medication at the stage where the cancer is still localized, that will give chance for cure and chance for response better than to stay and to come later on.
Mm. That's certainly new for me, having worked in that space. I suppose I left the clinical space in 2014. So that's actually quite new for me. And it's, again, you know, Wasim, what you're saying is very reassuring, because you're actually seeing patients much earlier on, with much higher potential, you know, for managing them better and well. With that, I suppose I just want to clarify then, would you see patients with stage one and stage two prostate cancer or not at all?
You know, Helen, not all stage one or two, they are stage one and two. For example, there is a people that will come to the clinic with PSA of 20. And what scan it showed, like a localized prostate and the biopsy, it's confirmed the diagnosis. And that's the localized, but there's people that would come with a higher PSA, more aggressive tumor on the biopsy, and the scan showed again the usual scan, like an MRI of the prostate, it will show just the cancer is localized to the prostate. But now we have more sensitive image like the PSMA scan, and yeah, that patient we believe is high risk, and the PSMA scan can change the total management. It might change the stage. So from stage 2, it will end up to be stage 4. But also, it will save the patient unnecessary kind of intervention. And it will make us to introduce the treatment early. And we know that for definitive, it will have a good outcome.
And Wasim, would you mind explaining to our listeners what PMSA is? It's obviously a staging test, but just so that they're aware and know about it.
So usually the usual staging for prostate cancer is an MRI scan of the prostate and the CT scan, that the scan to involve the whole body from the neck down to the pelvis, and we'll do bone scan as well. And that would be more sensitive for the bones. But nowadays we have the PSMA scan. It's again, it's like the CT scan. However, we'll inject a material that will be highly sensitive to the prostate cancer. And it will highlight at the place where there is a cancer. And that's more sensitive, more accurate, and will give us like more information. But to be eligible for that scan, your PSA level should be high in the form of more than 0.2.
We'll just reiterate that. So to be eligible for that PSMA scan, the PSA has to be higher than 0.2.
Exactly.
After first-line treatment, Wasim, is it?
No, regardless.
And I suppose something we have talked about with the, I suppose, after surgery and with Gerard's there with the radiotherapist, are patients who present after surgery with positive margins. Do you see that cohort of patient as well?
You know, we use not to see them because the next step, it will be a radiotherapy, and it's still the same. Unless we think that it's not only positive margin, it's the cancer beyond the prostate, at that time we will step in. But for positive margin, it will be, I think, resurgery is difficult. But the radiation therapy and the salvage radiotherapy, that's the best treatment to date, yeah.
Okay. Wasim, the treatments that you have available to offer to patients are generally in the form of chemotherapy, maybe targeted therapy, and probably hormone therapy. Would I be right in saying that?
Exactly. So the first treatment we can offer the patient, just no treatment, and to observe them and to keep them under close follow-up. And we can step in once needed in early stage. Then the ministry of treatment is the ADT, that's the hormone treatment, that the androgen deprivation treatment. That's the main treatment of prostate cancer. That can be for short period, like for 3 years after radiation therapy, or it can be for lifelong for people with advanced disease. Then recently, actually, since maybe 2012 and onward, we have the novel anti-androgen treatment. It's again blocking the action of the androgen on the tissue. So it's a hot tablet. It's in general well tolerated. So that's the next step. We have the chemotherapy. Chemotherapy, an old regimen was before and still up to date. We tried to get rid of it, but we believe there is a major role for chemotherapy in prostate cancer management. Not for everyone, but at one stage.
So for a select group of patients, you would be offering chemotherapy still? Yeah. Okay, that's interesting. And hormone therapy for 3 years seems like a long time, Wasim. What are are there risks and benefits? Obviously, the benefits are, I suppose, you know, downregulating and keeping the cancer under control. Are there any risks attached to that?
Definitely. So the benefit, because, you know, the prostate cancer is a male hormone cancer. So you have to suppress that one. And you have a different way to do that one, either by surgery or orchidectomy, by removing the both testes. That was the old fashion. And the advantage of that one is one surgery and that's it. But the disadvantage is huge psychological impact, and it's irreversible things. Then we came to found the hormone treatment, and we have more than hormone. We have what we call it an agonist and antagonist. those different types. So for example, the agonist, both of them like an intramuscular injection or an injection form. And the agonist, it's more local action and more costly. While the antagonist is you need time to work, less skin interaction and less cost. And you ask a really important question, and usually that's the main things, you know, why we like to see the prostate cancer patient in our clinic to discuss these important things, because the hormone is not an easy. Hormone is going to affect the life of that person, because the what we call it an acute side effect or the early side effect, it can decrease the libido and affect the sexual life, affect the erectile, and also can cause like hot flush and fatigue. That's the common early sign or early effects. So that's the easy things. Usually the main things to prevent this or to reduce the impact of this, the good education and to talk to the patient about it. For that reason, usually we'll talk to our patient in the clinic. Then he will go to meet one of the CNS to discuss the same topic. Then he will have the written information. Then he will come to visit us a few weeks later for another education, usually like a group discussion with other patients where they can
cover
this topic.
That sounds interesting that they come together with a group of patients to discuss you know, the treatment and side effect profile. And that's initiated by the team, Wasim, by yourself and by the clinical nurse specialist, is it?
Exactly, yes.
And tell me a little bit more about chemotherapy then. I know you said it was for a very select group of patients, but again, you know, what type of patient and what would be the side effects that one would need to look out for?
Okay, so the chemotherapy, the first indication for what we call it high volume metastatic prostate cancer. That means when the cancer spread to more than 4 spots in the bones or if involved any organ like the liver, lung, those people, we call them high volume. And we still believe that the chemotherapy is the best initial treatment. So usually it will be in IV form every 2 weeks.
I'll just clarify there for our listeners, Wasim, that IV would be directly into the veins. So intravenous into the veins,
okay. Intravenous. And usually every 2 weeks and most likely from 9 to 12 cycles. And that's it from the chemotherapy. Then we'll continue with the oral tablet.
And would the follow-up be fairly vigorous with that or with that form of treatment? I guess you're seeing them every couple of weeks in the oncology day unit anyway, aren't you?
Exactly. Every 2 weeks, then there's like a questionnaire that will be run by the nurses every time to check the side effects. They will review their bloods and to be sure they're fit for it. Yeah. Usually we'll see our patient after the 4th cycle, then after the 8th cycle, because not everyone will tolerate the chemotherapy. Despite that, in majority, they would do very well with it. Then once we stop the chemotherapy, we'll decide if we will give them an oral hormone treatment.
And I suppose we're coming to a point here where, you know, we're going to talk about a sensitive subject where maybe someone is not doing so well on their chemotherapy and they're not doing so well on the hormone therapy because of the side effect profile. What happens then?
That's still there, but just to tell you, Helen, it's only the minority of people because now the chemotherapy is not like before. For example, same chemotherapy, we used to give it like with 75 milligram per meter square. That's a high dose. And every 3 weeks. But we find that to give it in a smaller dose, like 50 milligram per meter square, every 2 weeks, it's usually well tolerated. We have a chance to reduce it further. And also to go lower than that, like 2 steps to reduce it. And if they didn't tolerate, we can switch them to an oral agent, the antiandrogen. Usually it's good and will control the cancer for like a time period.
So that sounds good and it sounds very holistic. The next question I'd like to ask you, Wasim, would be, you know, at this point in time, patients and families probably need that extra bit of support and care, especially if they've had, you know, as I said, the high volume of spread and metastases. Do you refer patients on to a palliative care team? And at what point would you consider doing that?
Okay, that's a good question, Helen. Actually, in particular, the palliative team, they're really good people. And I think they need to be involved from the start, from the day of the diagnosis with any type of cancer, either prostate cancer or any type of cancer. Because the role of palliative team is not only at the end of life, that's what used to be or what the people think about it. But actually, they have another role to control the symptoms and to control the symptoms from the chemotherapy or from the hormone treatment. They're really good people to be. So from our practice, usually we introduce our patient to the palliative team early in his diagnosis, maybe sometimes from the first visit to the oncology, because that will give them chance to know the palliative team and will give the palliative team to know the patient and to try to help them in a better way. But I think we have another service here in our hospital, that is psycho-oncology.
Oh, yeah. Tell me a little bit about that, Wasim.
Yeah, I think, I myself didn't appreciate their role until they are practicing that. They're really good. Because they can talk to the patient about everything. They can discuss like sensitive topics like sexual issue and side effects, relationship issues with them. Mm. Also, they have like good, tricky advice, not pharmaceutical. They will not give medicine. Usually they will talk to the patient and they will advise them to change their lifestyle, change their exercise habit, change their daily habits. And that's really effective. Usually my patient, for example, once I would refer them, I like to ask them how he found them. And most of them, they're really helpful. So psycho-oncologist, the dietitian, and also the physiotherapist, they're really an important people to be involved in the prostate cancer and the palliative team from early.
They're really good. They're really good points you've raised, Wasim, in terms of survival. So good nutrition, a good exercise regime, and we know the evidence around exercise can actually, keep prostate cancer at bay or even reduce risks in the initial phases. And the whole early referral to palliative care is so important. So you've adopted a very holistic approach to care. It's really important to seek those kind of services, even if they're not offered to you, to ask the questions about them, to ask about the dietitian, to ask about maybe referral to an exercise program, and to actually ask for referral to psycho-oncology if it's available. I know it's something that was quite challenging in years gone by, but I know there's been a certain amount of funding put towards psycho-oncology care, and most of the 8 centres in Ireland will now have access to that supportive service. But equally, just actually even talking to medical social workers within hospitals, I think is really important in terms of, providing that holistic approach to care, looking at how patients are and what their needs are outside of cancer itself. Before we come to an end, I do want to talk to you about clinical trials. I know you're a principal investigator yourself in international studies in different types of cancer, like lung, but also in genitourinary. So when would be a good time for a patient maybe to ask you about clinical trials, or when would you actually consider discussing clinical trials with a patient?
Okay, it's from day zero. Even before we'll see our patient, once we'll get the referral about this patient, or we know that his case discussed at the MD at our multidisciplinary meeting, usually we'll suggest a clinical trial like we have here in Mater Hospital, a clinical trial for early stage, even with radiation. And then we have a clinical trial like on relapse. We have the clinical trial as a first line treatment. So usually it's part of our job to assess what availability of the clinical trial, either in our hospital or in other hospital here in Ireland, then advise the patient about it. Some of the clinical trials seem to be promising and better than the standard of care or what we have. And usually we'll give the patient information from the first visit. And okay. We will inform the trial nurse about this patient even before we see him for first time. They will assess him based on whatever information we have, if he's eligible or not. Then we'll talk to patient. Usually they will see him on the first day after we meet the patient, if he in agreement to go or to consider it. They will see him on the same day. They will give him information about it. Then the patient has a chance to read whatever and to ask and maybe to do online search and to come back to us with his decision.
I guess my final question to you would be, what would you want your listeners to take away from our discussion today?
Okay, so maybe the most important thing is that prostate cancer is not like the past. We have a lot of new treatment, and there's a lot of advances over the last few years. So don't be shy. Don't hide your symptoms. Contact your GP as early as possible, because to find the prostate cancer and treat it at early stage is much better than at late stage. Even at later stage, it's not too late. Still, there is a treatment for that, and we will try our aim to improve the quantity of life. That's excellent, but also the quality of life. Whatever medication, we will try to adjust as we could, and not every medication suitable for everyone. No, yeah. He has his own. So just go to your GP, linked with the medical team, reach to the team, and we will try to help you through this journey.
Yeah, early detection is really important, isn't it, Wasim? So thank you so much for your time and your expertise today and the passion that you bring, to the treatment of men with prostate cancer. It's very enlightening to know that there is so much treatment available there and clinical trials as well. So, men and those born with prostates will be very well looked after. But the key is to actually, find and think about and be vigilant with your own body, know if there's any changes occurring, and actually talk to your GP about the possibility of a PSA test in the first instance and take it from there. Thank you so much, Wasim.
Excellent. Thank you, everyone.
That's all for this episode. Thank you once again to our brilliant guest speakers for their insight, to our sponsors Janssen for their support in making this series possible, and to all of you for tuning in. Join us next time where we will once again be talking all about prostate cancer. And in the meantime, you can visit mariekeating.ie for more on Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. Tune in next time, but until then, have a great week.